So welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era that is no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems. We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting further economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong, and my co-host, Bernie Stephan, is taking a break today, and we'll be talking about soil carbon sequestration today. The telephone in New Mexico, we have Courtney White, who is co-founder of the Kivera Coalition, and in the studio, we have John Wick, carbon farmer here in Nicasio. So are you there, Courtney? Hello, are you there, Courtney?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm a little fumbling today.
That's okay. I'm here.
Okay, great. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Hey, Courtney.
And John.
Hi, John.
John is in the studio, too. And welcome, John Wick.
Hello there.
Post Carbon Radio. Okay, let me first give you a little more introduction to Courtney, founder and creative director of Kivera Coalition, a former archaeologist and Sierra Club activist. Courtney dropped out of the conflict industry in 1997 and co-founded the Kivera Coalition. Today, his work with Kivera concentrates on building economic and ecological resilience on working landscapes, with a special emphasis on carbon ranching and the new agrarian movement. So, and John is, what do you call your ranch, John?
Nicasio Native Grass Ranch.
Yeah. I've worked a lot with John with the Marin Carbon Project, which John and Jeff co-founded.
Yeah.
And they've been doing research on sequestering carbon and doing the hard scientific research. And we'll get an update on the Marin Carbon Project. But you guys know each other, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you went down there for a work conference or a workshop.
Yeah, Jeff Creek and I both presented. Mm-hmm. It's been probably 3 years. Is that about right, Courtney?
Well, let me think. It'll be 4 years, actually, this fall, November 2010.
Yeah. That was
nine
fun.
Nine lives, right? Mm-hmm. Gosh.
Great. Tell us a little bit more about the Kivera Coalition. I know you're putting on a conference because this year is the UN conference. What do they call it? About family farms, right?
It's the International Year of the Family Farmer, or family mm-hmm. farming, and we added the word ranching to it. So it's International Year of Family Farming and Ranching. We do an annual conference in November in Albuquerque. It draws about 500 folks, which is a capacity for us, and it's a very interesting blend of ranchers and farmers, conservationists, public lands managers, scientists, the public, all looking for what we call common sense or kind of the radical center solutions to problems. And in 2010, we did one on the carbon ranch, this idea of carbon sequestration in soils. And I had met John and Jeff earlier that year, heard about them, read about them, went out to see John at his ranch, and pretty excited about what I heard and saw. And they graciously came and spoke at the conference, as did a number of other folks, including Christine Jones, who's probably the preeminent soil carbon sequestration scientist and advocate in the world. And I'm happy to say that Christine's coming back this year to give us an update on what's going on in Australia, because that's where she's from, and kind of a lot of stuff going on down there. So this year we're looking at the international, it's called Back to the Future. We're going to look at old practices that are new in some way, and Jo Robinson's going to come and talk about her research on vegetables and wild food, and Fred Kirschman's coming to talk about organic farming, and we've got folks talking about agrivoltaic systems and farming and ranching, all kinds of stuff.
I wanted to add in, Courtney, you also have a young agrarian component to your good work. And could you speak a little bit about that? Because that's really some of the most exciting things you do.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, yeah, it's, it really is exciting. So back in 2008, we decided to start an apprenticeship program through the Quivira Coalition, which puts young people on progressively managed farms and ranches. And it's grown every year. We call it a new agrarian program. And we often get 100 applicants for a single spot, which is really amazing. There's a strong hunger, desire by young people to get into organic and progressive farming and ranching or food systems at some level, and we've been really kind of overwhelmed by it. So we graduated about, 15 or 16 young people at this point. They're full-year apprenticeships. Either on we have a dairy that's part of the system, and a number of ranches and a couple of farms, pretty much all in New Mexico or Colorado at this point. But we've tried to expand it. The program is growing. If anybody who's listening is interested, they can go on our website or just sort of type in new agrarian. You'll find the newsletter at various places. Yeah, it's exciting. It's neat to kind of see the next generation coming on. I've actually turned the organization over to a young person, Avery Anderson, who's running it. It's important to kind of walk that talk of turning things over, and I've tried to do it. And a lot of ranchers and farmers are trying to figure out what their roles are in all of this, too.
That's wonderful news, Courtney, because that was one of my concerns, is that with peak oil and declining fossil fuels, we'll have to have more hands on deck, so to speak, to run these farms and to replace farmers. I think the average age of farmers now is, what, 55, 60?
60.
60, yeah. Right. So we're going to need a whole new army of young farmers out there growing our good, healthy food.
Well, you know, and one of the speakers this year is Doran Cox, who is a young farmer in New Hampshire that I profiled in the book, started something called Farm Hack, which is a kind of a virtual coffee shop. So what's really interesting about young farmers and ranchers that I've talked to is their blend of kind of old knowledge, you know, kind of farming and ranching knowledge with new technology and business savvy. I mean, it's... Doran uses a lot of kind of high-tech stuff to monitor his farm. The Extel folks that farming is not rocket science. It's more complex than that, which is an interesting way of putting it. And so he uses the internet to work with his neighbors. They do open source stuff. They share their discoveries, and they built a biodiesel facility, a truck that they all jointly use. It's really, really interesting and encouraging to see kind of this the generational interest in new technology blended with, you know, old things like organic farming, for example. And, you know, carbon sequestration is definitely part of that mix, too.
Courtney, I forgot to mention the book you've just written, that's just out. It's called Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. And it's a marvelous read. I've just learned so much from it, and it does give me hope. All we need to do is scale everything up. So let's maybe go down to the basics about the carbon cycle. Can you, John, would you like to start with that?
Just from a personal perspective, what I've learned now, starting working on our landscape, which is was a dairy in Nicasio until 1958, and then was turned into a beef pasture system. Our management of that has been a tremendous education for me. And when I began that in 1998 with my wife Peggy, I did not realize that all of the carbon and carbohydrates comes from the air and nowhere else. Had I thought about it, I would have thought that the carbon came in through the roots of plants from the soil. But it's the opposite. And what we've been working now with amazing researchers on our system is to measure management practices that we have now demonstrated ship carbon from the atmosphere through plants into the soil at a rate that's really significant. So in that process, there is a lot of carbon that's re-released to the atmosphere as CO2, but that's a good emission because that shows you that the system is alive. And the normal respiration of microorganisms in the soil is a good thing. And what we've shown is that that can occur, and at the same time, there can be carbon also moving into the soil system into a more permanent form while still producing food and fiber. And so that's a very exciting idea, that we could be managing this agricultural system in a way that restores the very resource base from which it's all derived.
Courtney, would you like to add anything to that?
No. Well, there's a lot to add to it. You know, for folks who are listening, it's called the carbon cycle. You know, I think what I found, and I include myself in this, is that many folks don't understand the carbon cycle and certainly how important carbon is to life on the planet. You know, life would be impossible without it. And we have to figure out how to manage it in a positive way rather than sort of negative ways. We think of carbon generally as a problem, you know, a pollutant, too much carbon here, too much carbon dissolving in the oceans, things like that. But there are physical processes at work. You know, John described how carbon dioxide, you know, passes through plants into the soils. But there's also kind of an attitude that goes with it. They're thinking about carbon, thinking about the positive role it plays. And that's kind of a lot of what the book is about. It's about those physical processes, but also about kind of our way of looking at the world. And I'll just say that chapter one is the Marin Carbon Project. And I talk about, some of the shifts in attitude that went on. I see this so much in our work with ranchers. You know, you look at the cow, you look at the grass, you look at the processes one way, and it's kind of shift your mental attitude from them being a problem to being a solution. And it's the same thing. It's the same cattle, it's the same grass, it's the same soil. But it's just how you kind of look at it. It's more of a mental shift than anything else. And suddenly these become tools for productive management and use of these landscapes, rather than, I come out of the environmental movement where I was told repeatedly that cattle were irredeemable. I mean, there was just nothing that they could do right on these landscapes, particularly on public lands. And I believed it for a long time because that's kind of the only thing I ever heard. And then I actually met ranchers and learned that the story was more complex than that. And I met some very progressive ranchers who said, no, we use cattle as a tool, you know, to improve the land's health. And, you know, that got explained to me. So it was really sort of a long educational journey for me, thinking about, in fact, Aldo Leopold has a great quote that the same tools that they had degraded land can be used to restore it, a cow, axe, fire, plow, and gun. And, you know, it's how those tools are used. So, to make a long story short there, the carbon potentials of the soil are using really the same tools that had degraded it for all this time. It's just kind of looking at it differently, managing it differently, the way John has managed his ranch. And then suddenly are all these, this sort of universe of possibilities opens up. And it is hopeful. I ended up at the end of the book thinking, wow, look at all these possibilities. And yes, scale is the question. Making an economy out of it is a challenge. Getting past some policy hurdles is a challenge. But, the toolbox, the practices, what we know about the processes, thanks to the scientists, is pretty darn amazing.
Well, John can speak to that after 5 years of research on 7 years, of course, now, and actually moving out into working ranches and farms now, I understand. So can you give us a little update on the Marin Carbon Project, John?
Sure, I can. But first I wanted to touch on a couple things Courtney said. One of them is what we see as agronomists are grass and cattle. But what we've developed is the ability to actually observe things that we can't see with the naked eye, and that's where research comes in. And so bringing in the high-resolution management or measurement technologies, working with universities.
Getting the baseline.
Getting the baseline and also understanding what's happening in the microorganism and the molecular level beneath these systems. All of a sudden, we can see in an agricultural system, just as in a wilderness or a wildness system, that the plants and the populations of animals are an expression of your success managing the soil below them. So looking at soil biogeochemistry is the floor on which our success as agriculturalists or natural systems managers is based. So that's what we've introduced into this conversation. When I started, I was purely looking at grass plants and animals. We didn't own any animals at that point and still don't. But we were able to introduce cattle into our ranch as a management tool to promote native grass ranch or to promote native grass species without planting a seed. And it works. And we can do that because it turns out that cattle are a very good proxy for elk. We know, working with Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, that the gut bacteria in cattle is just next to the gut bacteria in elk. So I have an animal that's a proxy for an elk. It has a very similar body weight, very similar hoof or impact on the soil from its body weight, and that the dung it deposits on the soil system is very similar in terms of providing bacteria to the soil that's very similar to what the elk population used to do in this system. So if I manage my cattle mimicking the movement of elk through the system as a migratory event, what we're seeing now on our ranch is the shift back to native perennial species without planting a seed.
But you're also putting compost.
Well, this, so there's a couple things, many things happening on my ranch. Mm-hmm. The most of the ranch is simply managed by cattle grazing. And we're doing that specifically to promote ground nesting bird habitat, and we're very successful. Our research plots are very clearly described, and we tested the idea of whether we could increase soil carbon. It was a very simple scientific experiment. We just wondered if you could, and if you did, what happened. So we got a baseline in 2008 on 35 sites in Marin and Sonoma of beef pasture and dairy pastures to find out what our baseline carbon levels were of these lands under management, typical of what we wanted to look at. The reason we're looking at rangelands, grazed rangelands, is because they are the single largest cover type on Earth. There are more acres or hectares of rangeland than anything else. Most of them are grazed, and grazing management is a very important event for humans. So looking scientifically at an intact system currently under management held great promise to help the climate crisis if we could ship carbon into that soil system through management. So the question was, could we increase soil carbon? The way to establish that was first to find out what your carbon levels are before you try and add any. We did a baseline soil survey for between January and May of 2008 on 35 sites in Marin and Sonoma, and we found some amazing things. We found a broad range of carbon levels, 50 to 250 tons of carbon per hectare, which is 2.5 acres. And then when we looked at the high carbon sites to see why they had more carbon, we determined that they had all had wet dairy manure applied to them as a treatment. And it was a disposal solution that ranchers did to get rid of their manure, or dairymen did. But they did it because it promoted grass growth over the long term, and it got rid of a waste product. Now, there are a lot of downsides to wet dairy manure application, greenhouse gases being one of them. So we don't know the net balance or the net benefit of carbon and greenhouse gases from dairy manure. We didn't at our baseline. But we did determine that those manured sites had significantly more carbon in a more permanent form in the soil than the unmanured sites. Based on that, Dr. Silver at UC Berkeley sent that soil and had it carbon dated. And this is really interesting and really important. In 1996, the French had an atmospheric nuclear test, which released a radioisotope into the atmosphere. We found that 10-year-old carbon a meter deep in those high carbon sites, and we found a lot of it. Dr. Silver said she was looking for a needle in a haystack, and she found bricks. We found a massive quantity of 10-year-old carbon a meter deep in Marin County soils in land that had been treated with dairy manure. We didn't know the net benefit of the manure application, so we discussed an alternate treatment of putting compost on those test plots to test this idea ourselves. We did that in December of 2008, and then within 6 months, we measured a ton more carbon in a permanent form in these soil systems from that single half-inch application of compost. And then we let the experiment run. So for 7 years now, what we've measured is an increase of soil carbon every year from a single application of compost. Very exciting outcome. We've also seen an increased water holding capacity and increased forage production of a more nutritious grass.
So how does it look with the drought we're currently in?
So, interestingly, a lot of people were anxious about increasing the fertility of these grazed rangeland systems that might promote, as it might promote more weeds. We did not see any increase in weeds. And in fact, this last year, what we've measured and seen is a significant increase of the native grass plants without planting a seed. So over 6 years now, the test plots compared to the control have shifted towards a deeper rooted perennial plant, and there are green ones. So we're in the middle of a drought, and we have green grass.
One more question, John. What working ranches are you doing research on now?
So the initial experiment was done both on my ranch and up in the Sierras at the university site, owned site. Then within a couple of years, we wanted to see what it would look like on working dairies. So we put in the same experiment into land managed by Bob Giacomini, by John Taylor, and by the LaFranchis in Nicasio. And we saw the same results across the board. We also tested other things like manure compared to compost. Mm-hmm. Based on that result and other things that had developed through our research in terms of the life cycle assessment, which was very favorable, we were then able to go at scale to demonstrate what this would look like on full field treatment. So we got thousands of yards of compost out last November up at the Stemple Creek Ranch, the Strauss Dairy, and the Quarter Ranch on the way to Petaluma.
Courtney, I know you're in your book, you could probably corroborate what John is saying on other ranches that you've visited.
Well, yeah, to a certain degree. What John and Wendy have done is put good solid numbers to what a lot of folks feel intuitively, meaning that, you know, the way they manage the landscapes, if there were bare soil 1 year and green growing plants there the next year due to management, we assume that more carbon is being stored in the soils. And thanks to the Marine Carbon Project and what they've been doing there, there are now more numbers to be put on it. John, Mike, are the ranches you're working with, are they going to be, is there a grazing-only component at some point, or is it still mostly compost being put out on landscapes? Is it?
Oh, it's absolutely compost on grazed rangelands, okay. Because that's what we have data on. And it's important to know that we're doing this on Mediterranean rangeland. 60% right. of California is Mediterranean. We did some preliminary inquiry into grazing only, and this is a confusing thing, but since we're doing science, our composted plots needed to have control plots next to them, and they were randomly assigned. And then we replicated these blocks of plots three times in my ranch and then up in the Sierras. So we have a background of grazed only next to a plot that had a half inch of compost put on it. And at least for the first 3 years, the grazed only plots are actually losing carbon. So what we've demonstrated scientifically with very rigorous measurement is that grazing alone did not arrest the degradation that these systems are in the middle of right now. Globally, rangeland systems look like they're crashing, and grazing alone at this point does not look like it has changed that. But a single addition of carbon, a biologically stable carbon in the form of compost, reverses that condition. And then from then on, the grazing is spectacular. So we cannot say with any data right now that grazing alone sequesters carbon. We have six blocks of plots on my ranch with controls that were only grazed, and I've been doing this as my best grazing management. And for the first time last year, the first time ever, on four out of the six plots, we started to see a measurable increase of grass, but no carbon. So many years into it, grazing only, I've started to see on two-thirds of my plots an increase of grass only. Now, that doesn't mean to me as a manager that I know what I'm doing yet, because if two-thirds of my samples are different than one-third, what's the difference? Same ranch, same grazing, same grass. What happened there?
John, I haven't been out to your ranch recently, but if we were to look at these different plots, what color? Most of the hills here you look at are brown, totally dry.
So this year was a very different year for us. For the first time in 9 years, I did not graze due to several circumstances. And the net effect of that was that this was my best seed production year yet. And since we had achieved what looks like about 20% coverage of my ranch with native perennials, this was the year to let them all go to seed. Had I grazed it like I normally do, I would have removed all that seed and the cattle would have eaten it. So this year, we let the whole ranch go ungrazed, produced a tremendous amount of seed. And now to look at it from a distance, it's the same golden color. But when you go into it and look at these plots, underneath it is the beautiful green grass. And I should also point out that with having soil moisture probes, we actually know that the soil's wetter.
Wonderful. Sounds good. In your book, Courtney, you cover a lot of, you've went to a lot of places researching to Australia, different parts of New Hampshire, and tell us some about, Emporia, Kansas, you covered how cover crops will add in the essential minerals. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because with our industrial agriculture, we know that through the use of petrochemicals and GMOs that the nutrient values in our food have been declining.
Right, and this was news to me again, like a lot of it when I started this. And this actually was something that Christine Jones said at the same conference that John and Jeff spoke at, that she was talking about nutrients in foods, meaning nutrients in the soil, how minerals, essential minerals, pass through plants and through the soil, through roots into plants, and then into us eventually when we eat the plants or eat the animals that eat the plants. And she told the audience that it was possible today to buy an orange in Australia that had essentially no vitamin C in it. And it's sort of hard to believe, but I've read about it in some other places. Basically, we have lost a lot of the nutrient content of our food going back just a couple generations, and a lot of reasons for it, a lot to do with soil health and the downgrade of soil biology through chemical agriculture across a lot of landscapes, and how plant roots access nutrients in soils. And her own research showed that when you move back to a biological farming system, whether it's with cattle or sheep or organic farming, when you reactivate the biology in the soils, that the plants can access those nutrients, those essential minerals, better, and they get remineralized as a consequence. And then we eat the plants, or eat the animals, eat the plants, and they're back in us. The cover cropping stuff is part of kind of a movement globally towards no-till, no-tilling, no-plowing. This is also news to me. I know a lot about ranching. I didn't know much about farming. I didn't quite understand when I started this what tilling can do negatively to the not only just the carbon context, but to the biology, the life of soils. Turning soil over like that exposes that microbiology to heat and light and air and all that kind of stuff. The plow itself can rip up mycorrhizal fungi, which are some of the key players in the whole sort of transfer of carbon back and forth. They're sort of the carbon brokers between plant roots and the rest of the soil. Plowing just kind of just decimates mycorrhizal fungi. All these kind of negative things come from plowing, from tilling, releasing carbon back up into the atmosphere, that kind of stuff. And so there's, and not for carbon consequences so much, but a number of farmers and other folks looking, going back to a kind of a cover cropping system where they basically don't want bare soil year round. So there's kind of a lot of stuff you can do there. Keep soil covered, even in the winter. There's a downside to it. A lot of no-till farmers in the Midwest, corn and soybean farmers, use a lot of herbicides and pesticides to deal with the weeds, because when you don't turn soil over, the weeds can kind of have a party and off they go. In the book, I profile Rodale Institute's organic no-till system that they developed, which is largely built around a roller crimper that they put on the tractor to kind of crimp cover crops. I won't go into all the details, but it was exciting to see and hear and learn about how all this stuff meshes together, how cover crops keep the soil moist, that they help plants reach nutrients that might not otherwise. And then they can be folded into organic systems, say producing above ground the organic crops that we want, that has carbon consequences, all this kind of stuff, kind of linking up through soil management, above ground and below ground, different ways that are done. I don't know what 98% of American agriculture is. Is what chemical agriculture, and this is looking at the other 2% that is hopeful that we get back to those scale strategies, the scale questions, and policy questions that kind of bedevil us on a bunch of levels. So,
Courtney, we're going to take a short break to identify our station, and then we'll come right back to our conversation. You're listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin, Point Reyes Station, and Bolinas, 90.5 FM Point Reyes Station, and 89.9 FM Bolinas, and now 92.3 in the San Geronimo Valley, and streaming live at kwmr.org. Support for KWMR programming is brought to you by the Bolinas Fire Protection District, reminding listeners that wildland fire season is here. Clearing brush around homes and roads allow for emergency access. More information about the Bolinas Fire Protection District and about fire safety at 415-868-1566. And our program today is about soil carbon sequestration and young farmers getting back to the soil. We're talking with Courtney White of the Quirera Coalition in New Mexico, who's just written a book called Grass, Soil, and Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. And I'm in the studio here with John Wick, a Nicasio farmer. So back to our conversation.
There's actually a great segue here. You just described the fire danger in Bolinas.
Right. That's right.
All of that material could be composted and then put on the soil system to ignite a state change that results in increased water holding capacity, which buffers against fire.
Yes. Courtney, tell us about the situation there in New Mexico. I understand that you're undergoing a drought there also.
We are. Nothing quite on the scale I think you guys are going through. I don't know if you've had any. Summer's not a rainy season for California, right? So it's a rainy season for us. We're actually, as I talk on the phone to you, I'm listening to thunder overhead. There's a pretty good summer monsoon season here. But yeah, the long-term trends are for an increased drying, hotter and drier, which we've all talked about in our conferences and other things, how to handle it, how to think about it. The issue of water holding capacity of soils becomes very important in this context. A lot of ranchers and farmers are struggling here. And unfortunately, the issues of climate change hit rural folks quick. There's not enough water. We're a dry state to start off with. The average precipitation across the state is probably about 15 inches, 14 inches a year. So it's, we get into stress pretty quick when we don't have enough rain, like parts of California. A lot of folks are looking and thinking about drought mitigation strategies, what to do. If we could wave a magic wand and, increase the carbon content of these soils, we'd be able to retain more moisture in the soils. And we've seen that through a lot of creek restoration work that we've done out here, working right in riparian areas to repair them, stop them from eroding and downcutting, trying to get green things to grow, sedges and rushes and other willows and other things. And these become sort of critically important in these landscapes. We're all kind of sweating out the drought here, too. Do we keep calling it drought? I don't know if it's going to be a persistent condition. I wonder if it's a drought anymore. I mean, if it's something else, I don't know.
It's California
normal. Going to rebound?
It's the new normal.
What's that?
It's the new normal.
It's the new normal, right? Yeah. Fortunately, it doesn't seem to pause at the new normal. It seems to keep going. So. I haven't heard much California news recently, but I was there a while ago, and it seemed, again, awfully dry. So,
I've heard a lot of ranchers are selling off their herd because they can't, they don't have the forage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and driving up cattle prices and beef prices as a consequence. So, it's tough all over. I guess not in the Northwest or Montana. I guess things are better up there. Colorado is okay, but no, we're in kind of a persistent new normal condition down here that nobody really wants to think about it, to be honest with you.
Let's move on to your chapter on coexistence. You went to Australia to talk to Colin Sice, I believe, about pasture cropping. This was something I hadn't heard about.
Yeah, and a lot of people haven't. And I'd heard about pasture cropping kind of through the grapevine, through other folks, and that got a chance to go to Australia and see it firsthand. And let's see, so the kind of the best way to describe it is Colin, it's kind of the cover cropping idea, but using rangelands or pastures, the perennial plants of pastures as the cover crop. And what Colin does, and this was worked out between him and a neighbor who really had the original idea, was to no-till drill a annual crop, like oats in this case, into his perennial pasture in the winter, in the dormant season, and up comes the cash crop, the annual crop, oats, and he uses, he harvests it, and so there's a product off his land there, and then he turns the animals out later, and he has found, it's kind of a little more technical about kind of grasses, C3s and C4 type grasses, plants, and he, as a consequence, is able to produce two food crops, one for his animals, and the other crop is a sheep, though he's not a meat producer. He's using wool off the sheep from one plot of land, from his one part of his farm. And so he's really getting kind of two enterprises from one operation, in a sense. So it's profitable, but it turns out it's also ecologically very symbiotic. They've done a lot of tests and looking at the land and the soils and all that kind of stuff, and nature likes annuals and perennials and C3s and C4s to kind of all mix it up. It's humans that have tend to separate them apart. We also, later in the chapter, I talk about sheep and cattle working together on a different farm down there. And again, we tend to separate things, in this case, sheep and cattle. And I profile a rancher, a farmer, Eric Harvey, who runs a big flock of sheep and cattle together on his place. And he's it's very carefully managed. And he's seen a tremendous response in the plant community, the grass community on his farm. So there's coexistence on a number of levels between different kinds of plants, between different kinds of animals, and, you know, fundamentally how we coexist with the land, and thinking about how we produce food in a way that that doesn't degrade, that actually can't restore land health, land function, water, all kind of stuff. And I found that Australians, when I was down there, I went to a number of other places, just they're kind of leaps and bounds ahead of us in a lot of respects, thinking about these kinds of questions. Maybe with the exclusion of California, there's a lot of stuff going on. The rest of the West seems to be a little bit behind that, and that's why I think you haven't heard about pasture cropping. It's spread across Australia. There's something like 2,000 farms now do it. But when I made inquiries around here, a lot of folks didn't know about it, or if they did, they couldn't think of an example of pasture cropping actually being implemented out here, though I understand that there's some folks thinking about it in the Midwest, giving it a try. In that context, you really need a true dormant season to do this. Real kind of a cold part time of year. It's not really for the tropics or, you know, kind of that kind of climate. So, don't know about California, but it's an interesting idea, and it's worked well down there. And I think it has the potential, as I say in the book, to feed a lot of people potentially, and that's another challenge that we have for us. How are we going to feed all these folks? 2 billion more folks by 2050. Here is an interesting way to kind of looking at a landscape that could be regenerative biologically, ecologically, and also produce more food. And I'm hoping that pasture cropping takes off at some point, spreads around the world as an interesting practice to do.
That sounds great. Another something that I hadn't heard about was the use of solar panels, like in France, over farmland. Have you heard about that, John?
Well, I know it's a controversial thing here in this region because mm-hmm. of bird habitat threat, which is a conversation we should all have publicly. But I liked Courtney's coverage of it in his book. That was very exciting.
Tell us a little bit more about it, Courtney, please.
Sure. And I'll say quickly that the lead scientist for this project is going to be speaking at our conference in November. And so it was, it's called Agrivoltaic System. It was developed by a group of French scientists in southern France looking at, very briefly, just, you know, putting solar panels above farm fields. And they put them up about 12 feet, you know, so you can get under them. And the question they were trying to solve was kind of a European problem, which is they don't have a lot of space anymore for agriculture, and so then you get some conflict between renewable energy use, which needs space, and you need to grow food, particularly more food if you're going to feed more people, which also needs space. And so they're looking at a way to kind of combining the two together, and also looking at would shading the crops be an adaptive response to climate change? If temperatures are going to rise on us, and I know that the southern France is in kind of the crosshairs of the temperature rises projected for the Mediterranean area, would shading the crops, shading the workers, be pragmatic? Would it reduce production? You know, all those kinds of questions. So it was really quite an interesting research project with I thought, some pretty practical, real-world implications. And, you know, out here in New Mexico, we're, you know, worried about rising temperatures as well, with some pretty harsh conditions, you know, 7,000 feet, that kind of stuff. Could shading crops with solar panels be a useful idea? Their research showed that if you space the solar panels out properly, it doesn't reduce the productivity of the vegetables very much, a little bit, but the plants actually compensated. This is lettuce in this case, by spreading its leaves out a little bit more, so they didn't lose much productivity while shading it and producing renewable energy. So this was and it kind of gets into this larger debate about food versus fuel in general. You know, is land for biofuels, ethanol, palm oil kinds of things, or is there some way to regeneratively or sustainably combine the two, so we're not having to kind of choose between either or? I hadn't heard about the bird issues. I'm kind of curious what the bird issues are. Is it birds like the solar panels interfere somehow with the birds or nesting? Or
I don't know that there's any data behind it. I think it's mostly fear on the part of people who are most anxious about bird habitat. And I don't think that there's even a conversation happening around it, but there's a lot of resistance to even thinking about doing renewable energy in our area other than on rooftops. And I think it's a conversation that our community really needs to have and try and do some data collection to determine what the real issues are.
Okay. Well, this was a science project, so there's a lot of data, but it's probably specific to southern France and the conditions there, elevation, sunlight, that kind of stuff. So, but it was, you know, it's more a food for thought, so to speak, you know, kind of thinking about renewable energy. I mean, for example, the farm in France I don't think particularly progressive in any way. I think they were not organic, not thinking about carbon. It was just, you know, what happens if you put solar panels above a farm field? And they had control plots. One was vegetable only, one was solar panels only, and they compared lots of different stuff. It was just really an extremely interesting idea. I went out actually in May to France for a conference and got to talk to the scientists and look at some agroforestry work that they are doing, which is, you know, blending tree crops with pastures, grasses, as oats in this case. Europe is just, they're asking a lot of these questions about how we can regeneratively, sustainably increase both energy and food production. And my hat's off to the French National Agriculture Research Group. They're asking these questions, putting some pretty hard numbers, hard data analysis to it. If anybody who's listening is interested, I'd encourage them to come on out to Albuquerque in November and hear about it. He's going to update us. They're actually now putting solar panels. They were fixed. They're now putting them on wheels, basically, and being able to kind of rotate the solar panels to more effectively capture sunlight and move them so that mitigating some of the shade issues, and there's a question about rainfall when it rains. Is it blocking it? And turning the panels up down to get the maximum amount of moisture. It's interesting stuff, and it's good research. And I get excited when researchers and practitioners work together. We're very much like what happened in the Marin Carbon Project.
So it really does speak to the value of what you've brought to our world, Courtney, in terms of going out there and bringing a wide range of perspectives and ideas together in the form of a book. That's really a good thing you've done.
Yeah, some other
thank you.
Things that I found really interesting was the restoration of degraded land, bringing back wetlands and bayous and...
Let me pitch for beavers. I told folks in other interviews that this is not all about farming and ranching. It's about natural systems. It's about the role that beavers can play in systems. Fundamentally, it's about getting these systems back up to health and functioning properly the way they used to. Nature still has the best ideas. We tend to interfere and mess them up on large scales. And so reintroducing beavers and all that kind of good things that beavers do in landscapes. And, oh, by the way, beaver soils and beaver ponds seem to be good places to sequester carbon. Restoring creeks, this was something we've been into here for many years. We have a lot of degraded systems. I don't know about Marin, but out west here we've had a lot of hard use on these fairly fragile lands with not a lot of rain. And then Alden Leopold was writing about this in the 20s when he was out here, looking at the connection between overgrazing and gully formation. When rains come, there's not enough grass, and these systems really can degrade quickly in these soils. And this was news to me when I started, 10, 12 years ago looking at these. I didn't realize these systems were so such poor condition. I mean, you don't know. I mean, partly because we're kind of illiterate when we look at landscapes. Through a lot of hard work by a lot of different people, we have a pretty good toolbox now on how to restore these systems effectively using a lot of sort of bioengineering principles or soft engineering, rocks and sticks and mathematics, and a lot of volunteers. So we have a pretty good idea of how to get these systems functioning again. The main person we work with, Bill Zielak, calls it using nature to heal nature, meaning using the natural sort of biological processes, small floods, things like that, to get these systems going. And they come back quick. In the book, I talk about kind of the idea of a sweet spot, which is where you can have a lot of response for a fairly small amount of input, either money or animals or, creeks, rocks, sticks. You can have a pretty quick bounce back. Nature heals itself pretty quick if you give it a chance, particularly if water is involved. And we've seen that over and over here. Give nature a break. Give her a goose, goose it along a little bit with some help. These systems come back. And then all kinds of good things come from repairing creeks. Birds, water, all that kind of stuff, and ecological services that creeks provide to humans in terms of protecting watersheds and clean water coming down, that kind of stuff. And there's probably a carbon component too, so it all kind of fits together in a kind of neat way. All these co-benefits flow from getting more soil carbon in the ground, getting that microbial stuff going. So it's encouraging.
That's what fits with what we've measured now in our research, is where if you can offer a little bit of stable carbon, these natural systems know exactly what to do with it and go right to work with it. And it ignites a state change, and then from then on, the system acts differently. And it's a cascade of measurable benefits.
Courtney, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about the conference in November again, because there may be some farmers and ranchers interested here to go down there.
Yeah, you bet. We pick a theme every year. We've done all kinds of things, carbon ranching. We've did one on how to feed 9 billion people by 2050. Did one on adaptation. We did a whole one on young agrarians. We did a conference after John's conference. Every speaker was under 30, except for two, which was very exciting. It's really interesting to hear kind of their perspective. This year, we've had some heavy conferences. This year, we decided to do a conference a little bit on the lighter side, meaning that we wanted to have a kind of a celebration of family farming and ranching, along with conservation stuff. So the speakers all are on the theme of kind of back to the future. These are old practices or old ideas that are coming back. I mean, kind of the way that we used to eat grass-fed beef once upon a time a lot, and then we don't, and that's come back. Or organic farming used to be, everybody was an organic farmer once upon a time way back, and then it went away, and that's come back. So these kind of ideas of practices that are regenerative, that we knew were sustainable at one point, that are coming back, plus new ideas, new technology. I mean, the French scientist is coming out to talk about solar panels, about farm fields, which is, I think, kind of a neat blend of new technology with old concerns, how do we feed folks. Dorn Cox will be there. He's the young farmer from New Hampshire that's in the book, and he co-founded this Farm Hack, which is a virtual community that a lot of the young farmers spend the time on communicating to each other about problems, questions. I've got this tool, I've got this challenge. A lot of open source software kinds of things that they do, which is beyond my pay grade, but pretty darn interesting. Joe Robinson, as I said, talking about kind of rediscovering the nutritional value of wild foods.
That was interesting to me about the plants that we've selected to grow, that
right.
they're mostly what, carbohydrates and not so much right. nutrients. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think Joe's thesis is that once upon a time we had highly dense, what she calls densely nutritious food, largely based on the wild foods that we began to cultivate, and then over time through our selection and breeding of plants, we have bred out a lot of the nutritional value. So it's not just a soil issue that I described before, but it's also a kind of a what's in the plant itself issue, the kind of the genetics and things. And we did it for a lot of reasons, storage, transportation, but a lot of it was based on taste as well. The kind of, we didn't like bitter things, we liked sweet things, and over time, that's all taken a huge toll on the nutritional value of our foods. And her book, which is called Eating Wild, I believe, argues that we need to find food that is as close to its wild progenitors as possible. And she said, you can't just simply walk into a natural food store and assume that everything there is densely nutritious. It may not be. And she kind of goes vegetable by vegetable and fruit by fruit, kind of talking about what's happened to them. She's a very interesting person. She's a researcher, she's a journalist, but she reads the scientific literature very closely, and she admits that it can be kind of tedious going, but she gets excited about the latest study on this kind of vitamin from this kind of plant, and then she processes that and puts it all together in a book. Yeah, so she's coming to kind of give us the update on that.
Great. Courtney, we're going to have to wrap it up.
Sure,
I'm
sure.
Sorry, we could go on and on, I'm sure.
Yeah, we could.
But I want to mention your book again, Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. If you want some hope, here, this is it. There are lots of great examples to how we're going to meet the challenge if we can only scale it up. And so I want to thank you for joining us today, Courtney.
I thank you for the opportunity. And good to hear John. Good to hear you, John.
Yeah, a pleasure.
And your website, real quick.
Well, the book's published by Chelsea Green. Go to their website for the book, but also they got tons and tons of other great books. There are lots of stuff. My website is called westlitworks.com. Quivira, spelled Q-U-I-V-I-R-A.